July 26, 1997. We're in Corvallis, Oregon. We're talking to
Bob Henderson.
Yeah, I'm doing this for a sound check. Okay. Bob Henderson. Bob, when were you born?
I was born June 28, 1944.
In
Southern California.
And where in Southern California?
Monterey Park, which was a little place, part of Los Angeles, as I understand. Mm-hmm. I don't remember it.
The southern part of Los Angeles, right. Yeah. And what were your parents' occupation at the time you were born?
My father worked for the telephone company, and my mother was...
Have either of them any college education?
My mother...
I'm assuming they were Methodists.
No.
No, see? Wrong again.
No.
Okay.
I don't know why my mom went to a Methodist college.
Yes. Just to confound me, yeah, when I asked the question. Yeah. That's all.
We didn't attend church regularly. Uh-huh. When I was little, we went to Sunday school, but it was an on and off kind of thing.
But you grew up in you were in Monterey Park.
Well, I was. Yeah. I don't remember Monterey Park at all. Mm-hmm. We lived in earliest that I remember is Anaheim, mm-hmm, about 10 miles from Disneyland. I remember Disneyland being built in about 1954. Mm-hmm. Used to be orange groves, and
I was there when it opened.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
Okay.
I remember it distinctly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, those were taken out, and there was construction for some period of time. Mm-hmm. Then when I was in third grade, we moved to a house that my mother and father had built about 10 miles away up in the hills, called Villa Park. It was, mm-hmm, out in the sticks. There's a lot of flats there now, mm-hmm, but it used to be out in the hills. Up until I went away to college, mm-hmm, and Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. Mm-hmm. First 2 years, I lived in the dormitory. Biology. Interested in biology, but about my must have been about my junior year, the third year, I lost interest. I said I could only see myself looking through a microscope, and which was short-sighted. I realized
yes,
that.
But when you're only a yes.
But at that point in time, mm-hmm, my heart wasn't in it, and it seems like the Peace Corps had. The concept of the Peace Corps had been initiated, and this was probably a 1960s idea, really became important to me. I should backtrack a bit. I was in a dormitory for 2 years. I started attending, well, when I first went to college, I was lonely, and I started attending the Wesley Fellowship at the United Methodist Church there. The reason I chose that, because my mother had gone to a Wesleyan college, and mm-hmm, I thought, oh, okay, that's a good mm-hmm one to go to. Mm-hmm. And there I met friends who became important in my life in many ways and are still important today. Eventually, Dave Nesmith, in college, I asked if I'd like to live in the Wesley House, which was a group sponsored by the Methodist Church, but it was a college house of men, and there was a men's Wesley, and there was a women's Wesley, and in the men's Wesley, it was an old house, there was about 10 people that lived there. And I moved into Wesley House, and and Dave Nesmith was one of the people in the house at that time. Between the experiences in that house and in the Wesley Foundation, and gradually changed in ways that it wouldn't have changed if I hadn't had that experience. Mm-hmm. At 6 o'clock in the evenings, we would. This is a house where we took turns cooking and cleaning the house. We did everything ourselves. No, mm-hmm, one did anything for us. But in the evenings, part of the fellowship, you know, the social interaction was to watch CBS News at 6 o'clock with Walter Cronkite, and that was something, you know, we almost did every night. And being the what was happening in Vietnam, making me think more about the war. war. Plus, we were all of draft age and eligible for the draft. Had a few people that had come from stronger church backgrounds, and they were, as I remember, I think Dave had filed as a conscientious objector. Dave's dad eventually did file as a conscientious objector. My draft board, a very conservative area. Not only did I move into IVS, so became more interested. I was losing interest in biology per se, and I became more interested in the concept of the Peace Corps and helping people who I felt were less fortunate than me, sort of a to try to help other people if possible. I changed my major. I changed it to agriculture, actually to farm management. I was looking at the agricultural curriculum and looking at crop science and husbandry, and I thought, well, if I take farm management, I can take some of both and plus have some management skills. So I became a farmer to manage farms necessarily, but it was a means to get courses in both areas. I felt that agriculture is something that I could use in the future to help others. I grew up, we had two and a half acres, and I'd been active in the 4-H club. Both my mother and my father had been active as project leaders and agricultures, even though, and they came from an agricultural background in Nebraska, but even though we only lived on 2.5 acres and I'd never been involved in commercial agriculture, the concept of working in agriculture with people that people around the world appealed to me. And I had the thought of, someday going into the Peace Corps or something like that. Let's see. Actually applied to the Peace Corps, and one day walking through one of the buildings, whether it was a biology or a sociology building, I remember seeing a poster on a board. It was actually an advertisement for IVS. And I think this was before I realized that Dave was applying for IVS, or I'd already applied to IVS. I got the information, brought it home, and I forget the sequence of events, but I did apply to IVS. I didn't apply until later. Dave had applied and was accepted to go to Vietnam with IVS. Dave hadn't finished his degree yet. We were the same year in school. Dave went to IVS before finishing, about 1 year before finishing, and I had applied to IVS, both Peace Corps and IVS, was accepted into IVS, and actually followed Dave a year later.
Did you finish your education?
I finished my education.
And what did you get your 4-year degree in?
Well, I ended up being there 5 years.
No.
Slow learner.
You came back later and finished?
No. Oh. I forget the exact sequence, but it took me 5 years. And maybe Dave was ahead of me in that. I thought we were about the same, but regardless. It took me 5 years to finish up all of the requirements for the farm management major. Applied to IVS. Dave's father was a pastor. He'd moved from, Dave's family lived in Santa Maria, but at that point in time they'd moved up to the Presidio area in the San Francisco area, as I remember. And his father was pastoring a church, and I remember that got word that Don Luce was going to be coming to the U.S. for a visit and was going to be speaking in Dave's father's church in the San Francisco area. So another friend in the house, Denny Morton, and I got in my Rambler, and we started from San Luis Obispo up to San Francisco. And partway out of town, heard this thumping sound, and the main bearing of the car that I had bought not too long ago went out. Mm-hmm. So we hitched a ride back to town, and eventually got the car back to town, and then I took the bus back up to San Francisco, and was able to hear Don speak when he came and spoke at the church there. And I told him the sequence, you know, whether I'd already been accepted or just mm-hmm. what. But I told Don that I was interested in working in Vietnam specifically. Later, I guess it was later that I learned that I was accepted to work with IVS, but I was actually accepted to the program in Laos. Mm-hmm. And so after I graduated sometime in June, and it was also sometime in June that I was scheduled to go to Harper's Ferry for orientation. And at that time I had a girlfriend, and so we went to, on my way to Washington, D.C., we went to Montreal. I think it must have been the World's Fair in Montreal at that time, mm-hmm. before going on to Washington, D.C.
You drove?
No, we flew. We mm-hmm. each flew respectively mm-hmm. and met there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had a nice time at the fair, and then I went on to Washington, D.C. Family, when I left my family, packed my bags and had a case, and it was labeled to go to Laos, and I thought I was going to Laos, and they thought I was going to Laos. But when I got to Washington, D.C., I asked the staff if I could change and go to Vietnam. And it seems like it was John Hughes that I spoke with. Mm-hmm. This is a number of years ago. This is 1967. This would have been June of 1967. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned that I had applied as a conscientious objector. Never got a response from my draft board. Mm-hmm. I never done anything other than what I had, which was, let's see, I had a student deferment, and then it was changed to 1A. And I wrote a letter when I knew I was accepted to go to IVS, and I knew that IVS was accepted as an alternative service. I wrote a letter to my draft board and said, well, I'm considering this as doing alternative service. Mm-hmm. Heard letter and never heard from my draft board again.
No, you're fortunate in that Orange County.
Yes, right.
California, anyway, mm-hmm. from my experience of mm-hmm. interviewing. Mm-hmm. But because it was so large, they knew they had other volunteers from that area, or they were understood the selective service law,
yeah.
or they simply had enough males and they didn't know that was enough for them not to do that. And the same thing in LA. Never heard from my draft board.
Really? Well, I felt fortunate. There was no way I was going to be drafted.
Mm-hmm. Did you believe, thinking back to then, why did you believe that it was, how did you formulate that opinion back then?
Oh, I've never been very strong as a political person, mm-hmm. but I just felt that what was being done to common people was wrong. I may not have understood the history or the politics involved. I just felt that common people were getting caught up in this and being hurt, killed, when that shouldn't happen. And I saw the American government involved in a military solution. I later could see that most U.S. soldiers that were there not because they wanted to be there, but because they were drafted and they were looking forward to the day that they could go home. They didn't really understand the situation very well. But prior to actually meeting some mm-hmm. in Vietnam, all I had was what I understood through the news media, the things that were happening to the common people. And again, this was because I was a biology agriculture major. I didn't have a lot of training in political science and didn't understand the politics involved.
Yeah, but a lot of, we're getting to some questions I'm asking, but a lot of people who were raised on farms, for example, who were agriculturalists, mm-hmm. who always wanted to be an agriculturalist, mm-hmm. just presumed that if the United States saw bad guys, you know, in a foreign country, then it was our obligation to help those who wished not to. Had very little political sophistication either, but they came to a very different conclusion.
Yeah. Well, I work with agriculture today, mm-hmm. and the agriculture community is a fairly conservative mm-hmm. community. Mm-hmm. And I can understand that, and my politics today, while they may be conservative in some regards, they're not conservative in terms of form or war in general. Mm-hmm. And I don't support the Democratic platform necessarily mm-hmm. either. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just saying, I guess today I don't consider myself, I consider myself liberal, although on a scale, people looking at me would say, hey, he's fairly conservative. But I'm on the, I guess I'm on the wind of the liberal side of the equation.
Well, actually, what I was trying to look at is a lot of people with ag backgrounds mm-hmm. didn't see any problem with the war or mm-hmm. their participation in terms of assisting Vietnamese on the IVS level, which was apolitical. Yeah. But they also didn't see any problem in assisting the South Vietnamese government survive the threat of communism. What I'm really asking you is, what was happening to the people of Vietnam was a consequence of a civil war. The United States had gone on one side of that country. Think of what the results would be if, for example, the communists took over the whole country. Wouldn't people suffer also?
Potentially they could.
Mm-hmm.
Focus their attention on something that's evil.
Mm-hmm.
I have to honestly admit, I wasn't looking at the politics one way or another way.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking at human beings, mm-hmm. regardless of who they were, what color they were, being caught up in something that was caused by decisions of people sitting at the top making these decisions that mm-hmm. were affecting common people down below.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt that was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I naively felt that, all right, I want to do something that shows that not all Americans feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
That feel that, well, you solve things militarily. That, hey, here's at least one person that cares about you as a person, that doesn't, of how you dress or what you do or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I have to accept the fact that my naive politics hasn't changed too much over the years. because I still feel that way many ways today.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had signed up for IVS. You went to Harper's Ferry, and you said, well, is there any way I can not go to Laos?
Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. It's my job.
Okay. Keep the brain focused here.
That's right.
I asked, and I'm pretty sure it was John Hughes that I spoke with at the time, and I explained that I was sincerely interested in going to Vietnam because I had filed as a conscientious objector. I considered myself was interested in what was happening in Vietnam, and I really wanted to go to Vietnam as opposed to Laos. I said that I let John know that I had met Don and visited with Don when he had come to the coast. And John was kind enough to say, well, let me send a telegram to Don and see what the situation is. And he did that.
Mm-hmm.
Don was gracious enough to say, yeah, we could use another person. And so at Harper's Ferry, my destination changed.
Mm-hmm.
My luggage had been sent ahead. It went to Laos. All of us, whether we were going to those that were working in
agriculture or community development, whether it be Vietnam or Laos. Mm-hmm. We went to the Philippines mm-hmm. for about 10 days. Mm-hmm. We stayed in the agricultural college at Los Baños. Mm-hmm. We had some training classes at the International Rice Research Institute at Erie. A little bit of experience of working with a caribou, pulling a plow. So it was a good introduction to maybe Asian society and a little bit of training and rice planting. It was a whirlwind kind of training. It was only 10 days. We stayed in the dormitories at the college there. From there we split up, and the group that went to Laos went on and went on to Vietnam. At that point in time, I later realized that there was quite a buildup of IVS members in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I think 1967 was probably the biggest group that there had been and was since, mm-hmm. and I was a part of that. We were in Vietnam. We were in Saigon for a little while. I can't remember exactly where we stayed. We stayed in a dormitory somewhere. Mm-hmm. We took our meals at a restaurant that had where arrangements had been made for us. For language training, I went to Nha Trang. Mm-hmm. Several of us went to Nha Trang, where we stayed at the IVS house there, I think. And I was there for only about 6 weeks before I was sent to Bao Lop.
How can you spell it?
B-A-O-L-O-C mm-hmm. in Lam Dong province, or the Mon. And I was actually replacing an IVSer who was finishing his tour. His name was Bruce Holderried. I had met Bruce briefly. I can't remember when. Bruce lived in teacher's quarters at the agriculture school there. It's Trung Trung Hap Nam Lam Su, history and agriculture technical school. Mm-hmm. It was one of the few agricultural technical schools that were in the country at that time. There was one there, I think there was one down in Kanta. Anyway, I lived in teacher's quarters at the school. But I was by myself all of a sudden, and that's when things began to set in that hey, I didn't have much language, and all of a sudden here I am, and it took some getting used to. There was a also on the school grounds at the other end. Fortunately, there was a MACV compound. I don't know what can't remember what MACV stands for.
Military Assistance Command Vietnam.
Okay. Mm-hmm. A U.S. military base mm-hmm. with concertina wire and the mines and everything. And they had taken some of the teachers' quarters at the other end of the campus and were there. It was a large, older campus. Mm-hmm. That had, I believe it had actually been a college at one time, many years past. Anyway, Bao Lop is a small town. I made a real effort to try to keep separate and not be seen as a part of the U.S. military side. There was also a USAID contingent in town, and I did allow myself with time to become friendly. My language abilities were so limited. I didn't have the abilities to speak mature, I mean, the thoughts that a mature person would have, mm-hmm. the concerns. And so I felt the need to talk to somebody about feelings other than what I could do with my limited elementary level mm-hmm. Vietnamese. I was plunked into the school there. Wasn't really given much guidance. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was just me, I was certainly a part of it, being naive, not, you know, this was my first job out of college. And being in a country where I felt things were going, I felt things were wrong in terms of the war. I was an American. I was identified with the American presence, but I didn't want to be. I was plunked down and said, okay, now it's time to do your thing. But I wasn't sure what that thing was. Mm-hmm. And part of it may be because at the time, there wasn't a lot of structure or guidance from administration. I don't say that in an unkind way. Mm-hmm. We did have team leaders that did give us guidance. It seemed like the assumption was that we had the technical background, we had the training, now we were to go to work and use it. And I think that there were probably some people that were able to do that. But I think that there was also some of us that floundered and were trying to say, well, okay, what are my real strengths and skills and how do I use them here? The one that came natural was when teachers asked, you know, would I help teach an English class? Well, I'd never been an English teacher before, but English, mm-hmm. and that's what they wanted, is the pronunciation, and that's something I could do. Mm-hmm. So it was a door opener. It certainly was for me, and I think probably a lot of people. It wasn't something that I wanted to do, but at least I felt I was doing something mm-hmm. to earn my, well, maybe to earn part of my stipend of $80 a month. It was actually more than that. $80 a month was put into a bank account in U.S. for us, and we had a living allowance mm-hmm. In Vietnamese piastres there. And for a single person, it was plenty adequate.
Mm-hmm. For a cook, were you able to hire a cook, or where did you eat?
When I first went there, I was by myself, and I was told that I could get meals. You know, other teachers got meals from one of the local restaurants. You mm-hmm. could make arrangements at a restaurant, and they would have one of the children deliver meals to you. Mm-hmm. You would buy a lunch bucket, mm-hmm. you know, it's a stacked series mm-hmm. of buckets, and you could get kombua, rice for the day, and or meal for the day. And I remember thinking, well, now how am I going to do this? And going through my dictionary and trying to write down, I wrote it out in English is what I thought I wanted to say, and then I tried translating that into Vietnamese.
It doesn't really work.
It doesn't work that way.
Believe me, I've tried. Yeah.
And so I went into the little restaurant just off of the edge of the school campus there and was trying to explain this and show them my note, and finally they got the message is what I was wanting to do. It was sort of comical, but they were gracious, and they realized that I wanted meals brought to me, and they made the arrangements, and we worked out a price. I can't remember what it was, but that's what I did, mm-hmm. and I guess I did that for, must have been lunch and for dinner, twice a day, and breakfast, you know, I just picked something myself. That's what I did for while I was alone. And then later, IBS sent another volunteer there. I guess a decision was made to send someone who could work with handicrafts. Mm-hmm. And Stuart Pettigrove, was sent there.
Hmm.
In case you're going there, Stu works down in Davis, UC Davis, with the Extension Service. He's right on the way.
I've met people twice.
Oh, George yeah. Stuart Pettigrove. He's an Extension Soil Specialist at UC Davis.
You know, Ray Borton is there. He was an early volunteer. He just retired.
Ray, when I came back from Vietnam, Ray was one of my teachers down in Cal Poly Pomona. Mm-hmm. When I came back from Vietnam, mm-hmm. I felt that I wanted to go to graduate school, and I started taking classes at Cal Poly Pomona, mm-hmm. where I was a teacher there at that okay. time.
Yeah, well, he's just retiring now. Okay. It's an amazing house. He has a rainforest in the atrium of his house.
Oh, really?
Oh, it's you're like in a jungle inside his house. It's wonderful.
How big is the atrium?
Well, it's not. It's actually a house that has the cantilevered ceiling, stuff okay. like that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there's a section about five, when you open the front door, you're in the house. Mm-hmm. But the A thing is open. Mm-hmm. And before, as you walk to the kitchen, you essentially walk through what would be the living room. Mm. But it's not. Mm. It's these plants that and stone and things, and the plants go all the way up into the you know, pandanus kind of leaf and uh-huh. all sorts of stuff. And it's wonderful. Oh. Very quiet guy, of course. But
interesting.
A riotous plant, mm-hmm. mm-hmm. reflecting the inner self, I think. Mm-hmm. But it was wonderful. I spent the night there.
He must have built the house himself.
I don't know. It looked like a modification. He may have. But it looked like it didn't look that unusual design.
Okay.
It was what they compelled the house to do.
Uh-huh.
My house is that way. I mean, I could do same thing with mine. It's just a kind of floor plan mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. With a tall thing and the beams come down like this, mm-hmm. Rather at a right angle that mm-hmm. create a very large space. Mm-hmm. But do you happen to have his number?
Yes, I do.
Good. Well, we'll get it. We'll get it later. I'll make a note there because I'll go right through you.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Oh, that's wonderful. Especially now I get the true stuff, not the stuff you're telling me, but what really happened up there. And so when they assigned Stu.
Well, they assigned Stu there, and so Stu.
Stu, is it Pettigrew?
Yeah, Stu Pettigrew.
Stu Pettigrew. Was sent up to help with creating handicrafts, but with a develop a handicrafts industry, so to speak. But there was another group already doing that.
Yeah, I forget exactly the details, but over in Zilin, which was about 20 kilometers away, mm-hmm. Towards Dalat, there was the Vietnam Christian Service had a team that was working with the Montagnard people in that area, helping both agriculturally, and one of the things that they were doing was helping the Montagnard people develop some of their skills in making their blankets, their weaving, or their bows, their crossbows, and things like this, to develop those so that they could market that. Essentially, the Montagnard people had been forced by the Vietnamese government to come into these relocation areas usually on the periphery of Vietnamese communities.
Literally, in some cases, on the periphery.
Literally. Right. And, you know, there was somewhat like a fortress. And rather than living in the forest, and ostensibly, you know, the reason was so the forest could be a free fire zone. Mm-hmm. And they could also watch them. And keep tabs on them, I believe. IVS had worked with the Montagnard people for many years, and the person in Baolup prior to me, or the people prior to me, worked with the Montagnard people. There was a Highland Training Center that had been developed with IVS's help. I think it was both Vietnamese government and IVS's help mm-hmm. some years before. And this training center provided classes to both men and women in the relocated Montagnard villages. They would come to the training class, receive training in sewing, in agriculture, in blacksmithing, mm-hmm. and then go home. And I didn't understand, my language ability wasn't such that I understood all of the workings involved. I wasn't involved administratively at all. I believe that they received some money from the Vietnamese government with the center to some degree. My role peripheral in terms of trying to help them
with transportation when they needed it, with supplies when they needed it. If there's things that I could help do. Back on, I mentioned Stu.
Mm-hmm.
IVS sent Stu to Bellop to the market for handicrafts. Stu lived with me, and I'm getting back to your question, you know, did we hire a cook? When there was two of us, we eventually decided that yes, if we hire a cook, the cook could help us learn Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody that we could talk to and not be afraid to share our inadequacies in terms of speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Of us, and she also washed our clothes, as I remember. It was a local laundry, and I do remember taking laundry down there a lot. Anyway, so, and then later there was a third volunteer that came, Richard Trenbath. Richard stayed in an apartment in the city, stayed with a Vietnamese family, and he was a language teacher, an English teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And was there in Bao Lop from probably 67 through important part of my personal story is that at the technical school, my wife was a language teacher. My wife today, Kim,
mm-hmm.
Was a language teacher of French there, and she was in one of my classes with the teachers there, and I got to know her through class, and we were eventually to do because the family lived in Saigon, and most families, respectable families, did not want their daughters to marry Americans because you could see Americans and Vietnamese women on the street,
mm-hmm.
and you just assumed that the relationship was not a serious relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't want, this was Kim's mother and sister, as her father, it's a major support, financial support of the family,
mm-hmm.
teaching there and sending
mm-hmm.
money home. And they didn't want her, their daughter, their sister, to be looked at that way. Actually, didn't understand that, you know, our relationship was a serious ceremony, and then we're married. This is over a period of time, but
mm-hmm. when were you married? What year were you married?
We were married in December of 1969.
Mm-hmm.
We were married. We could be married. When I asked my wife to marry me, she said, "Well,
you have to ask permission of parents."
Yeah. Well, she said the only way she could be married is if her mother gave permission.
Mm-hmm.
And that was difficult because my, I mean, I could speak kind
of thing to do
at the time. Yeah.
<your own language. laughs>
I think it was the crying that
the wailing didn't ask you to teeth. No.
When she originally said no,
yeah.
that originally changed the family. I had gotten to know the family over time.
Mm-hmm.
One summer, Kim, somewhat. This was before we knew each other very well, but I, you know, she was a pretty teacher, and she said, "Well, if you come to Saigon, you know, you're welcome to come to my house." It was more out of politeness than
mm-hmm.
a real invitation,
mm-hmm.
but I took it as an invitation. And so when I went there, I did stop by the family's house, and she wasn't there, but the rest of the family was surprised to see an American coming and asking. With time, got to know her family, and very wonderful people. Difficult at first.
Where are they today?
Kim's mother and two of her sisters have died. They were sisters that lived in the house with her mother at that time in the family's house. Her married sisters and brothers, they're up there in age, and they're still in Vietnam.
They're
today.
All still in Vietnam.
Not all.
No.
She has one younger brother.
Uh-huh.
And his wife, and they're here. They live in Texas,
mm-hmm.
and we sponsored them to come here. They were interested in having to go into the military, so they maybe the family,
mm-hmm.
just a year younger than her, but
mm-hmm.
you know, she'd always t-
taken care of him in many ways, and this was part of it. Here today, she's went to Washington, D.C. She has a niece and nephew, nieces and nephews who live in the Washington, D.C. area, and she was invited to go back there for one thing, and her brother and his wife went, and so it was a family reunion, and that's why she's not home today. She's also, what else?
Did you ever find, besides other the English classes, did you find a calling? Yeah,
things to do?
Yes.
Yes, but they're not things that I, that would fill impact reports. And
But you had to write a, you had to write a
we
letter.
We had to write monthly newsletters.
Yes, exactly.
And reading other people's newsletters, some of them seemed to be sort of travel logs, and some of them were impact, and I thought, gosh, it'd sure be nice if I had something important to do. But a number of the things I did was with students on campus. There were Boy Scouts. We did, you know, some fun things together. I mean, it wasn't just me. Mm-hmm. It was more teachers and me doing it. I was tagging along in many regards. One other thing in the community, in addition to the Montagnard Training Center, was which I'd gotten to know the pastor and his wife and his children, and they're great people. I didn't attend the training. And we got involved in designing and getting funding for a small poultry project. At that point in time, chickens had become very popular. In Vietnam, I think they were imported varieties, and they were, you could buy day-old chicks from some of the hatcheries, and vaccines for Newcastle disease, other diseases were available, and so I got involved in helping the pastor design a small chicken hedges and feeders and get going in that regard. Particular congregation, and he used that money not for his own support necessarily, but to help the congregation in general. So it was outreach. I look at it now, and I thought, well, that was rather parochial. I was working with one particular group, but I guess the reason I did, it was somebody, he'd asked me to teach him English, and I said, fine, if you could teach me some Vietnamese. And there's a contact, so you work with the people that you have contacts with, and this was a contact, and we did that. As I look back over my time there, there's no one big project that I can point to and say, that's what I did with my time. That's how I earned my money, and boy, didn't I earn it. I think that people I think I've met over time, whether in IVS or in gained a lot more from my experience than I was able to give. I honestly feel that. I don't think that I gave of what I could, but in terms of showing what I did, you know, accomplishments, they were more little intangible things, you know, getting to know people, getting to know me a little bit, and me getting to know them as people. What somebody should be paying you to do, though. That's the concern.
What were the goals of IVS?
Well, I don't know. The goals were to work in agricultural development, community development, education, those things. But it was very low key. It was low level.
When you realize how many billions of dollars were spent in Vietnam on projects, and how they virtually 90% of them would be invisible today. I wouldn't judge myself too harshly.
No, but it's a feeling I've had over time. I said, well, you know, I wish I had been more mature. I wish that I had been maybe out of school longer, that had some real working skills could bring and say, okay, this is how you do it. What I did have was sort of learn by doing and working with people. I guess I look at myself today, and I tells what abilities, what do I feel good about myself? And it's not the agricultural training I have. It's about myself is the ability that I have to feel compassion for people, enjoy people of other races, of other cultures, them as equals, and to, if there's something to be of help to them, then I will try to do that, or that happens to be. And I did do that at that time, but it was very low level. You know, whether it was garden seed that had been shipped to us in big barrels and we had that to make available. We did those kind of things, but, you know, this is, you know.
Yes, but the alternative would be large-scale technology designed to change people's pattern of existence and fear, or try to make them adopt agriculture or their real opportunities, to try to introduce commercial products which they could be dependent on, put them at the mercy of a world market. There are worse things, I would imagine, that could happen as a result of interacting with USAID personnel than low-level incremental association. But what I find is interesting is that actually the way you feel, that's why you went there.
Oh,
you went there
so.
To do that, and you did that.
I did that. Yeah. I just wish that I mm-hmm. could have been
more effective.
Mm-hmm. I think today, you know, I'm 30 years older.
Right, you have skills.
And right. I have a few more skills, but more than the skills, I have some experience with war. There's also not a war going on.
Mm-hmm.
At that point in time, it was very uncomfortable. Well, I say, you know, this was in my mind,
mm-hmm.
But it was not enjoyable being an American with an American war going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you were always wondering, well, you know, who do people think you are? Do they think you're CIA? Do they think you're a spy? You know, people that got to know me mm-hmm. would know that I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, people insist that until they get to know you.
Well, excuse me, this is a Vietnamese street.
On the Vietnamese street.
Yes,
yeah.
On the Vietnamese street, I think everybody knows everything.
Well, that's probably true.
Yes, if one person knows,
yeah.
I would imagine everyone else did too. Although you're never conscious of that at the time.
Right.
I'm sure that's the case.
The CIA drove Broncos, as I remember.
And in Laos, they wore sunglasses. It was a little, but the idea being, I remember when Americans started going to Hanoi in large numbers, that is 100. Or something. Everyone in Hanoi knew who the 100 Americans were, and then when it became 1,000, they knew the 1,000. But beyond that, they lost interest after that point.
Mm-hmm.
But people could say, "Oh, you came in on yesterday's plane."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of course, Hanoi is famous for being, you know, a big village.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
I would imagine a place like Khon Tum or Dak Tho or someplace like that, everyone would know. Someone knew if someone had figured it out. I think almost everyone would know. But since you brought it up, this war thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What was the war like up there, particularly before and after 68?
Well, before 68, all during the time that I was there,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was told, well, you don't travel the roads.
Mm-hmm.
I had a Jeep,
mm-hmm.
An IVS assigned Jeep, and is that within the city limits and a certain distance out.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of just getting on the road and going to Zilin, you know, I was told, well, you don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Later with time, I learned from other people that
mm-hmm.
you could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great feeling of freedom to be able to drive. But initially, you know, those were the constraints. You know, I said, well, you just don't do those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fortunate in that area. We didn't have, there wasn't an active military, I mean, there were U.S. troops there, there were Vietnamese troops there, there was a Navy MILFAP medical hospital team that was in there. In terms of the war, seeing the war on a daily basis,
mm-hmm.
it wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
But you, as an American, you didn't just get on the road and drive wherever you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
There were times that you would hear of attacks on villages, mortar attacks on villages, village or, you know, a
team would come in, and it's like, I was, one night, it seems like we were over at, later, Stu was living with me for a while, Stu Pettigrove lived with me for a while, then later Stu moved into town, he had his daughter landed close by. You know, that was about the scariest thing, somebody was hurt, it's the scariest thing that I can remember. Other than those kind of things, it wasn't like living...
You didn't put sandbags under your bed or anything
no,
like that?
No, I did not.
The did the Tet Offensive have any impact in that area?
No. Well, I shouldn't say. I was there. Did not become aware of what was happening until later, you know, got the news of what was happening in Saigon and other areas. Or anything dramatic happening right there in Bao Lop, per se.
Were there from, you got there in...
Arrived in country, well, in July of 67. Went to Nha Trang for language training for about 6 weeks, September. And from that point in time until when Keem and I were married, and this was after our marriage in December of 67, Keem resigned her position, or was coming to an end. My 2 years was up.
Yeah, your 2 years were up, yeah.
And I extended them for a bit.
Okay.
And we came here. See, we actually... She resigned her position, and we moved to Saigon, and we lived in the Saigon housing for, at the IBS house in Saigon for weeks before coming to the U.S. to visit my family here. And it was our intent not to come here to live here. It was to come, intent to come and have time here and then go back. I was interested in going back with a social service organization, be at IVS. I hadn't made those arrangements ahead of time. And because we were married, I needed a little bit more money than what I was getting at the time, I felt, and I wanted to be that kind of a position. Didn't find anything available at that time, at least when I wrote and actually talked to Hugh Mankey's program director at that time. Adon had already left. And many IVSers had left earlier in protest to the U.S. and Vietnamese governments invading Cambodia. I felt I wasn't ready to leave. This is actually, this was just shortly after I arrived in country, as I remember.
No, it wasn't about Cambodia. It was...
No, that's right. No,
it was earlier.
No. Yeah. My facts have gotten mixed
up. That's okay. Yeah.
This was protesting the war in general. That's right. I think Don had written a letter.
It had been just before you got there, though.
Happening. It was pretty much happening about that time, September of 67. And I felt, well, yeah, I don't know enough about this. I just got here. I'm not ready just to turn around.
Several other volunteers felt the same way. Regardless of their politics, they felt, hey, wait a minute.
I just felt that I wasn't ready to leave. If I'd been there and I felt leaving would help make a political statement, that's one thing. But this is something I'd really been looking forward to doing. And so I did not leave.
So what happened after 69 when you came back? I mean, how did you... talked to Hugh Mankey.
Yeah, came back here, you know, couldn't find a job with a social service organization to go back. I wrote a letter to Hugh and said, well, you know, is there any way that I could come back? I needed a visa to get into the country. You know, when we left the family, we didn't say, you know, we're leaving permanently, you know. And it was only fair to Keem to try to go back so she could be with her family. His mother was getting up to ask Hugh if I could come back and work with IVS on a at the IVS house. It would have been... Let me go back. 1970. And went back and IBS at the IBS house and worked with a couple of the other projects. There were there was a project of volunteers working there, coordinator, the ag leader.
Could you spell his name?
recalled her name, mm-hmm. but from Taiwan, mm-hmm. Yung Chang Lai, Y-O-U-N-G, leader at that point in time, and there were a couple of other volunteers also from Taiwan working with some of the villagers in Kuchi area. It was a refugee camp experience and doing this at home, and, mm-hmm. and I think Lai was involved in that one as well, and so it was, I had no experience there. I was tagging along and learning. I forget the details, but it did work with IVS on a small scale there on Vietnamese salary. IVS's demise. And I forget exactly when that was. It was 1970s, but it was coming to a close over some time.
Why was that?
Well, I mean, this was a protest against, as I remember, mm. Against the U.S. invasion in Cambodia at that mm-hmm. time. And there, us had actually spoken out against that at that point in time. Mm-hmm. And both the Vietnamese government and USAID, who was the primary funder of mm-hmm. IVS at that point in time, said, no, that's fine. We don't need you anymore. Basically, that was the close of the project, although it took some time to, it was still up in the air. There mm-hmm. were still some thoughts that, well, maybe it can turn around, maybe they'll change their mind. It wasn't clear at first as to who was making this decision. Mm-hmm. And I say this as a person who wasn't involved in administrative mm-hmm. circles. Mm-hmm. But as I understood hearing them talk and talking with them, it wasn't clear as to who was calling the shots. Mm-hmm. But with time it became apparent that it was a concerted effort to get rid of the, regardless of any good that IVS had done in the past, to get rid of people who, you don't bite the horse that, or don't bite the hand that feeds you. Mm-hmm. And I was there as IVS was involved in shipping it back to Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. Again, I wasn't ready to go home mm-hmm. Because we still had family there. And I felt that we needed to stay there with family that had gotten a job with AID, teaching me to do that. But I, briefly with the World Vision Street Boy project until I had a difference of opinion there.
Yeah. I'm so glad because it was really complex. We'd be here till 3 in the morning, and that worked out nicely. Yeah, and what did you?
Then I just happened to think, well, maybe I'll just go down to Pan Am and see if they had any jobs. And I went down and just asked, and they had a need for someone to sell tickets. Mm-hmm. And I had no training selling tickets, but they gave me training. There was another IVSer, Jay Scarborough.
Uh-huh. That's right. That's
who had already started working with IVS. Oh, excuse me, with Pan Am.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know that until I asked and was given the job. And basically, and Jay and I worked together. We ended up selling tickets together out at the Long Bin uh-huh. Air Base. These were R&R tickets. Mm-hmm. It wasn't something that I enjoyed, but it was a way to enable us to stay in country for a while. Mm-hmm. Until we really decided what we were going to do with our lives. Mm-hmm. And after I'd worked for Pan Am 6 months, I was able to purchase ability for my parents to come and to
discount tickets.
With discount tickets. Mm-hmm. And my parents were separated at that time. Mm-hmm. And so each my mother and my father came, I was able to provide them access to a ticket around the world, mm-hmm. and they paid for it. I didn't mm-hmm. have the money, but they each chose the route that they wanted to go and bought it at a discount. I think they were able to get it for 20% of what the normal price would have mm-hmm. been. Able them to come and visit us in Vietnam and to meet Kim's family.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really glad that each of them had that opportunity to do that. Mm-hmm. It was important to... Places were flowing, and mm-hmm. it just happened. It worked
mm-hmm.
out well.
Mm-hmm.
Later, it just felt that, let's see. Kim and I were expecting, I was a little bit concerned about maybe, my wife is rather small,
mm-hmm.
and so I was a little bit concerned about that, and I felt that, I'd really like her to be born here. This is sort of here, because our daughter was born in, is a breech position,
right.
and a cesarean operation.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know whether it was intuition or just, and she could have been born fine,
mm-hmm.
probably similarly in Vietnam, but we did come here. And felt that, I need to get my life together, and I felt that I really wanted to go to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And initially I thought...
So you went back to graduate school?
Came back mm-hmm. and started working a job at a hardware store, because we came back in late September, mid-September. Our daughter was born at the end of December, and so I needed to have a job to support us. And but with time, wanted to go back to graduate school. Wanted to go to graduate school,
mm-hmm.
and so started taking classes up at, took some at Cal State Fullerton, decided that no, I can't concentrate on the things that you need to go to medical school,
mm-hmm.
I just didn't have the mind for it, and so felt, I'd better take advantage of the training I had, so I went back to Cal Poly Pomona, commuted back and forth, working, and at that time I had a job with the hospital, which is now the UCI Medical Center,
mm-hmm.
There in Orange, ended up getting a second BS degree, and then came up here to Oregon to go to graduate school.
What happened after you got your degree? Assuming you got a graduate degree, what kind of degree was that?
The degree here I got it received here in at Oregon State University was a master's degree in agronomy.
Mm-hmm.
My training was in dryland agriculture,
mm-hmm.
Wheat production. Worked with a probe in measuring soil moisture, etc. As far as my thesis. After I graduated, I took a job with the Extension Service as an extension agent, a crops agent, which
mm-hmm.
had a 4-H portion to it
mm-hmm.
in Central Oregon, in Prineville. It's a fairly conservative area, but it was good training for me. Extension Service most closely meets my desire to, do things that are helpful with people,
mm-hmm.
With the training that I had,
mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed it very much.
Mm-hmm.
Today, after working there for 5 years, I was able to